Well, happy Independence Day, Alaska style, a holiday celebrated extravagantly in just about every community in the state. Maybe you're about to climb a hill in Seward or getting ready for a barbecue, but right now you're with us this morning on Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. If the phone's handy, maybe you can join in to talk about independence in Alaska. Do we have any? Call me now at 907-478-8255. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. What is Alaskan independence? The subject today on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, pour yourself a cup of coffee on this holiday morning, and thank you for joining us. In a moment, I will introduce a very capable panel to share our morning coffee with. The late Joe Vogler, founder and gubernatorial candidate for the Alaskan Independence Party, insisted his remains be put to rest in Canada because of his strong opposition to statehood. The late Wally Hickel, who was elected governor for the Alaskan Independence Party, was laid to rest standing up in a position to fight the federal government or any colonial interest that threatened his Alaska. Well, they're not able to join us this morning, though they have been on the show in the past. We do have a couple of other old white guys who have been on the show instead. The question is, are we gaining or losing independence in Alaska? If we want autonomy, how do we work towards it? If autonomy were suddenly thrust upon us, what would we suddenly realize we really needed and didn't have? That's a huge and speculative question, and we'll try to take it on piece by piece. Our phone number, 907-478-8255. Let's say, wait a minute. It's an 800 number, right? 1-800-478-8255. A local call on Anchorage at 550-8422. And email is talk@alaskapublic.org. So take a sip of that coffee, think it over, and let's see what these old white guys have to say. With us on this holiday morning is John Havelock, who got his degree from Harvard Law School the same year Alaska became a state and soon went to work in Governor Bill Egan's law department as assistant and then deputy and then finally attorney general. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska, John.
Good to be here with you, Steve.
Yeah, John, I'm so glad you could get up so nice and early. It looks like we're going to have a beautiful day. What do you have planned?
Astonishing.
What do you have planned for the rest of the 4th of July?
Well, we took a long trip and had our floor redone while we were gone, so I have to a whole lot of books I have to move back into bookshelves.
Oh, you would have books now, wouldn't you? Yeah, and from Bear Valley with us is Mike Kenny, 35-year member of Teamsters Local 959, leading the local from 2004 to 2007, and part of the Backbone 2 organization that campaigned for greater Alaska leverage over the oil and gas industry. And Mike, I think you're still a Democrat, aren't you?
Yes, I am a Democrat as far as that party exists, and it does. It has made some strides in the last few years. But
and
yeah,
you also would kind of played a role, I think, as most of organized labor did in the unity ticket that Governor Walker and Byron Mallott got elected on.
Bill Walker worked very closely with Governor Hickel, Malcolm Roberts, others on Backbone 2, trying to get an all-Alaska gas line. Got to meet him and very much supported his run for governor.
Well, I'm really glad to have both of you with me today.
I don't want you to think that you have just one political opinion here. There, I'm not happy at all with Governor Walker.
So. I would, like somehow I'm not surprised. and the other panelist is you at 1-800-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. And it seems that one of the things we could talk about here, gentlemen and ladies and audience, is implosion. When things implode, you can see the resistant structures better. For instance, about 30 years ago, and just 27 years into statehood, when Alaska imploded economically, 1986, only two banks survived, the oldest ones. First National, National Bank of Alaska. All the rest of them went under. Now we're having a recession, and maybe that makes it easier to see what resistant structures Alaska now has compared to 30 years ago. So where are we? I mean, we haven't collapsed. The economy has not collapsed, Mike, with the price of oil going down. It's kind of a little bit of a recession. But it seems like we're more diverse and robust than we were in 86. At least that's what they say.
We are, but I don't believe it's ever a healthy economic practice to rip through your savings in order to make day-to-day expenses balance out. At some point, we have got to determine that of revenue sources, new revenue sources, have got to be part of the solution of sustaining the state in the future.
So we don't even have that basic financial structure, fiscal structure in place right now.
If it's in place, it's certainly not being implemented by the political forces at play in general.
Yeah. You would agree with that, John Havlock?
Well, maybe more explicitly, I don't know what on earth we're doing without an income tax. That's ridiculous. And I'm also concerned about the ability of a political system that's based upon monetary contribution to make any kind of a fix of the situation. So I think we are in relatively deep trouble. I might add that I don't think that the distribution of wealth in Alaska is a good thing. There's too many poor people around. It's something that reflecting the national trend in suddenly having many more rich people and the top 10% and the top 1% getting everything.
Well, there's a, I mean, right now there is a little bit of a populist movement in Alaska, I think, surrounding the permanent fund dividend because the governor vetoed half of it last year and the legislature, however that lawsuit over that comes out, the legislature in its infinite wisdom reduced the permanent fund dividend this year. And so there is a, I mean, it can be argued, I think, that that dividend is one of the broadest distributions of resources the state could make, don't you think? In terms of what you were talking about, the division of wealth, because
yes.
Everybody gets it. Kids get it, everybody.
Right. It's a family welfare benefit for people that have children that that in some ways copies what goes on in the rest of the Western civilized world. And it's a benefit, and abolishing it or getting rid of it is a tax on the poor.
Yeah. So we do have that much. Mike, I would assume that you sort of go along with that.
Oh, absolutely. The permanent fund dividend is probably one of the pillars of our economy, especially in rural Alaska. It is, back in the day when it was being designed, it wasn't just for present-day Alaskans to go through. It was for seven generations out. It was, our Constitution says that the wealth should be shared or maximized for the benefit of Alaskans. It doesn't say just present-day Alaskans. I think Alaskans can be far into the future. And by the permanent fund, that is a way of taking a non-renewable resource and monetizing it for Alaskans for many, many decades and decades to come.
So we do. So that's one robust part of what we have in the structure. But it seems like we are lacking a very functional public policy machinery at the moment. In other words, we have, it's just legislature has a real hard time agreeing about stuff. I don't know, maybe if they did agree more, we'd like it less. I'm not really sure. But at the same time, John Havlock, you have argued, like 5 years ago now, you were on the show with your book, Let's Get It Right. Maybe you can hold it up. Hold it up for the camera there, John. That's it. Let's Get It Right. I understand there's still some copies available.
Yep.
And this book, we discussed it, and it was a very interesting conversation about how Alaska might have a constitutional convention, like it it votes on every 10 years, so it's coming up again in 2022, and maybe think about making our government more functional.
Absolutely. It's I mean, not to say that it wasn't a great concept, a great job in putting it together in the first place back in the 50s in anticipation of statehood. A lot of it was intended to please Congress. I know, for example, to take one improvement that would, I think, should be on the table, was on the table then, but they said the Congress would be unhappy with it, is unicameralism. What on earth are we doing, as small a population state as we are, with having two legislative bodies to squabble when, you know, the municipality of Anchorage and cities that are 10 times larger than the population of Alaska do quite well with a unicameral governance, to take one example?
Okay, but John, let's say that a Bill Allen situation arises again, and you get this legislature, and it enacts a bunch of policy that you don't that ain't good.
Well, that's the Bill Allen situation, as we're referring to the corruption of the legislature, is caused by another thing that you'd fix if you had a constitutional convention, which is the overwhelming power of money in our elections, and everybody's looking to that.
Yeah. Okay, well, Don joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Don.
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy holiday.
Yeah, it is indeed. Looks like it's going to be a nice day.
Yeah, let's hope so. I'm a vet. You touched on a PFD a little while ago.
We did indeed.
Yeah, I've been up here since 68, and I've been watching a lot of the things we're developing here, also related to the recession, whatever that we had here, and the fact that only a couple of banks survived back in 86. The most important factor that I've seen so far has not changed, and unfortunately neither has the approach changed. When I was with the Anchorage Central Labor Council, I pointed something out to some people, and I got some very serious frowns. The question was, what do we do on pay raises? Because we had some strikes going on at the time. And I tried to explain to them, I said, look, if you got people down here making $10, $15 an hour, and you're going to give them a 5% raise over a couple of years, 3-4 years, whatever, and you're going to give a same 5% raise to somebody making $3, $4, $5 an hour, who's going to come out on the losing end of it? The rich are going to get richer. The poor are going to get poorer. It's the same thing you've got now. That $1,000 that they took off the dividend, that hurt the poor guy a lot more than it did the person making $50,000, $60,000, or $100,000 a year.
You're right, yes.
Now, here's the kicker. If you give people their money, let them manage their own money. Let them spend it the way they want to spend it. And then you tax them as they spend it. What's going to happen?
Sounds
people
like you've
got the money, are going to spend, they're going to pay more tax.
So sounds like you, sales tax, you're friendly towards that idea. More than an income tax?
I keep hearing from people saying, well, it costs too much to manage a sales tax. It's a lot simpler for a income tax. And I'm saying, you got to be kidding. If that were the case, why do one of the first things they turn to is, we're going to tax alcohol, we're going to tax gasoline, we're going to tax cigarettes, one thing and another. If it really costs so much more, then why are we even bothering with it? So something's ambiguous in there.
Yeah.
And the law, the doctrine of ambiguity in law, is that a ruling on ambiguity in law is to be made unfavorably to the drafter. So the people who make laws that are ambiguous, the courts should be ruling against them, not on their side. they should not be giving them that extra advantage of the ambiguity. They should be taking it away from them and allowing the advantage to go to the have-nots.
Hey, Don, thanks for your call.
Yes, sir. You're welcome. Have a holiday.
All right, and the same to you and to everybody across Alaska. We're talking about Alaskan independence, Alaskan autonomy, moving towards self-sufficiency. What do we have that's robust in our economy and the structure of our state that we could be more self-sufficient? And how would we get there to where we were not so dependent on colonial forces and the federal government? And I think right now everybody would agree if we were amputated from the federal government, we'd lose a colossal amount of money. Don't you think, John Havlock?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Probably no argument there.
No, it would be a total disaster. In posing your question, it made me think about the various, any of these things that you apply in a particular time zone. And as you know, it's the time of statehood. People said, a big argument was that there's no way that the state can possibly finance itself at all.
Yeah.
We're even more dependent upon federal spending then. And incidentally, we get a whole lot more in federal spending than we give away to the feds and taxes.
Yeah.
And then so the one moment when it seemed to me that there was a possibility, if somebody really wanted to go back to Joe Volcker, was when Prudhoe Bay came in. We found Prudhoe Bay. And then suddenly we were in a position to be self-sufficient. Back now, when I look at the mess the economy is in, there's no way we could afford to survive as an independent country. No way.
Yeah. So you'd agree too, Mike Kenney, I would assume.
Yeah, I do. And just to jump back a little bit to the 84-86 recession, a lot of, that was triggered once again by the low price of our gold mine, our revenue stream from oil.
And the state payroll was collapsed.
It was the state payroll was collapsed, and the oil companies took that opportunity on the North Slope in 1984-85 to get rid of all union contractors and put Vico in charge of that. What that did was make the depression that we suffered, especially in Fairbanks, where a great deal of the North Slope work was centered, that really deepened the depression and led to more misery on the part of our citizens.
Very interesting piece of history there. Yeah, I hadn't even considered that, but that was a really, really bad recession. 40,000 mortgages were foreclosed on. 40,000 in a little state of Alaska. Yeah. It's just mind-blowing. And it happened. And, now we have, again, low oil price and probably for a while. And we're having trouble figuring out how to deal with it as a state. And it makes me think more about John's idea of how do we tailor our Constitution to render public policy a little bit more efficiently.
One of the provisions of the our state constitution, which is unique and lovable, is the corresponding obligations provision. It says that you have all these rights to liberty, equality, and et cetera, but you have corresponding obligations. And among those corresponding obligations is to stay tuned to what's going on in the political process. And, I'm very disappointed by the percentage of people that know anything about how the government is run. Percentage of people that vote is very disappointing. So that is certainly one of the corresponding obligations. Another is to pay taxes. And incidentally, the income tax really only applies to the top 25% of the population in income. And I notice people complaining. This drives me nuts. Hmm. Kind of the rural areas who are losing their permanent fund dividend, the tax, super tax on them, and resisting an income tax as an alternative.
And it probably you're arguing not in the interest of many rural Alaskans because the income tax wouldn't affect them much.
Oh, quite so. Yeah, it wouldn't affect them hardly at all.
But it would affect like I know in the oil industry alone, 700 million dollars of out-of-state wages paid out every year.
Yeah,
to in the oil industry alone, and close to 3 billion if you look at all out-of-state workers. At least that's what the state labor department says. So that's a revenue source that isn't tapped right now. Probably would need that if we were an independent state. We would probably need that.
Well, the independent state thing, I'm not sure what you do. What are you going to decide? You have an army or something? How about your State Department?
Missiles. Maybe we could get missiles. France maybe would give us missiles. Well, yeah, I like the whole fantasy aspect of Alaskan independence quite a bit. I mean, I like the idea of thinking about what sort of constitution could we have and what sort of treaties. You know, I think the number one treaty that we'd have to have would be what would be the relationship with the original Alaskans.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now that's a federal matter. And that is, if Alaska suddenly had to deal with that, that's a colossal amount of private land that belongs to these corporations. And, you don't change that. I don't think you change private land. And you have the whole business of Indian country, self-government, and all these rights. I mean, it can be argued that all us, people that came, we're not the original Alaskans. maybe an independent Alaska is a native Alaska, or at least it's certainly an Alaska with a little bit more native voice and governance. I mean, how many natives wrote the Constitution, for Pete's sake?
One.
Yeah? I mean, it just wasn't even thought of.
And there's something to be said about the Native culture. They have existed on this, one of the most important geopolitical places in the world, the keystone of the Pacific, Alaska. We are a very important piece of the puzzle for any geopolitical matters. We lived self-sufficiently, or the Alaska Native population lived self-sufficiently for 10,000 years. They did not use non-renewable resources. They were able to subsist, mainly, depending upon whether you're in Southeast or up in Point Hope. They were able to exist quite well. I think there are lessons to be learned from the people that settled this land that were able to exist. Of course, we have a lot to offer in terms of modernization, but those basic cultural values that they had certainly should not be lost to the mists of time.
And archaeology is showing us that some of the notions that we had back in the 50s with regards to indigenous people are incorrect, that there were actually parts of Alaska, particularly on the coast, were highly populated. The Aleutians, far more population, Alaska Peninsula, than it has now. So it wasn't necessarily sparse populations and resources that were not abundant. There was active management of the ecosystem, and the more archaeology that's done, the more it's shown exactly what you said, that these were people that were effectively managing the ecosystem that they lived in.
I think there's some risk in over-romancing that, though. And, as we move forward, as knowledge increases, as the nature of the economy increases, the idea of a subsistence economy is slowly fading out. And I might add, the idea of who is native is modified because intermarriage is making for some people that are, maybe an ancestor, 1/16th makes them a native because of their inheritance. So, and I, wouldn't want to get back to measuring blood quantum the way the horrible old federal rule was. So Byron Mallott once said to me, he said, "We understand that we are going to have to move to integrate in the economy. We just want to control the timing of it and make sure it doesn't happen so fast that it destroys values."
I think that's a very good insight, I think, of the timing. And it was pointed out to me in Arctic Village that, up in the more remote Athabascan communities, the contact with whatever outside culture, whether it was the traders that came up the river, the Russians, even the U.S. federal government has been very, very gradual. And they've had time to adapt and and appropriate a lot of things. I mean, they didn't have dog teams.
And the Native Claim Settlement Act is a great move in making that motion occur at a desirable rate. And incidentally, you're talking about village life. You might live till you were 40 years old if you're lucky. And so,
yeah. Well, there's also the you're exactly right. The everyday existence is gone, but the cultural values of being self-sufficient. Our lifeline is at Port of Anchorage for 90% of the goods that we have. I would say that having an investment instead of a bridge across a connect arm, having hydroponic projects that could grow of sources of food, of protein in Alaska, so you don't have to rely upon the outside. Of course, there would be some things that strawberries, et cetera, but it's the cultural values more than the everyday expression of those values in the last 10,000 years. But I think what I'm trying to get across is we need to be as self-sufficient as we can and not reliant upon either the government or corporations outside for our existence.
It seemed to me the central issue that I pick up from them is their sense of community. They did not overemphasize personal property and personal gain. They were there for each other, and we need to learn more of that for our own community, the rest of it.
The potlatch.
And of course, we're just, three old white guys talking about this, So it's not entirely our place, and it's a missing part of our dialogue, but a number of people that I try to get for this program are just busy with subsistence activities
I did spend a lot of time working on the Native Claim Settlement Act.
Indeed.
In my role earlier.
Yeah, and I would say that ideologically you're invested in it.
I mean, I say that. Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we could all sit here and start telling stories, but I would like to also bring in the people of Alaska. The phone number, 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. We're talking about Alaskan independence, Alaskan autonomy, the practicalities of a more autonomous Alaska, and what are the steps that might be entered into to get there. And one thing that's coming up is a constitution, changing our constitution. I want to get around to the idea of maybe thinking about what the Constitution of Alaska was drafted before Alaska was a state. So maybe we could start now thinking about some kind of constitution of Alaska as a nation and just start building it. Start prepping now. So I want to go to call from Wasilla, where William joins us. William, welcome to Talk of Alaska, and thanks for calling.
Yes, I like big government and all the benefits that come with it, but I think the thing that bothers a lot of people is how the government wastes taxes, and then people who are wealthy have special access to politicians. We all know that. It's an accepted way of doing business. But I'm still agonizing over the fact that we're still fighting the Korean War. We had no business in Vietnam. We had no business invading Iraq. We're still messing things up in the Middle East. And it's cost lives, and it cost millions and millions of dollars. So people get aggravated, not necessarily, well, let's go independent. But that's, in this day and age, we'd probably end up like the Crimea being annexed by Russia again. How about that?
Maybe we could have a treaty, though.
Oh, really? Like all the other treaties we've got?
Maybe a treaty with Canada.
Well, that would be our best bet, is to go in with Canada, because they seem to be a bit more reasonable in their political dealings around the world. And so we've gotten spoiled by our wealth in America, and so we've become sloppy in our interactions with foreign issues, and so we end up in wars just never seem to stop. And as long as you got taxpayers' money, you can still fight wars.
Yeah, well, it seems even you have a war against a state of mind right now.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, well,
but it's just a shame to see our tax wealth and our lives of our young people being used as soldiers for losing propositions. And that's what that Vietnam protesting was all about, Vietnam War.
Yeah.
So, you know, people know what justice is. You don't have to get a PhD to know what justice is.
I'm a vet also, Korean vintage, but I never got over to the war, thank heaven. And I couldn't agree with you more. We should not be messing around as an individual country with so little knowledge base. And I think it is a mistake to get away from global solutions where we have global entities, and there are a whole lot of them that can work these things and address these things with economics and diplomacy, and when necessary, ultimately call on force. But we should not be flailing out there alone, and the mess we made in Iraq is the most recent example.
William, I think that was well said.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your call. So we have John Havelock and Mike Kenny with us, and we're talking about Alaskan independence and government in general, big government, little government, our control of government, and we'll do more as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Joe Vogler's favorite song, Al Oster singing Beautiful Alaska. On Talk of Alaska, we're talking about Alaskan independence on Independence Day, and it's a great pleasure to have such an expert panel with me willing to come in on a beautiful 4th of July holiday and share an hour in the morning to converse about our beloved state. And you too. We got a stack of calls already and emails coming in, and this one from Heather, who says, hey, what about, let's think about Nigeria for a second. And she said, Nigeria was granted independence from Great Britain 1964, I think that would be, and it had been a colony from which oil riches were extracted and utilized by the British. And today, it's a colony of the oil industry. How's that different from Alaska? I think that's a rhetorical question. Thanks for that, Heather. And let's go to Caroline in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, gentlemen, for being there. A couple of things, but just to touch on that lady's comment, and I'm thinking into the future when we find rare earth minerals up here. And it has to do with Norway, sovereign country, Alaska, sovereign state. They are pushing in on $1 trillion in their legacy fund, and we're fighting over $54 billion, and they started 14 years after we did. So obviously they have a different approach. I think part of it may be seeing the oil industry that we are saying that we're taxing them, which nobody likes taxes, but we're not. We're not even getting our share or our ownership of the oil. But that's past tense. We're not getting back a farthing. I'm just concerned about us getting taken a second time. So that's number one. Oh, and by the way, I sat down and figured out the PFD throughout the total of time we've been giving it, plus the balance in our savings account, the 54B, and it comes up to, I think it's less than $75 billion. So anyway, that's sitting there, and I'd love somebody who knows why we did what we did to do it. As far as the federal money, I don't think it would take anybody much time, certainly not me because I don't have that that time, to compile a list of every year that Ted Stevens was our senator, what amount of money we got from the federal government, stated in today's money. And of course, some of the things were continuing year to year, but we should be able to look and see what he meant to our state in terms of the federal money that he brought in. And of course, there was a shade more in terms of the military being up here. So yeah, we did need the federal government because we got rid of the state income tax, which was here whenever I came in 67, the first time, and then back in 70. And also, there was a $10 fee, if I remember correctly, for each family for the schools.
School tax, right.
That got tossed. So it's a matter of us tough old self-sustaining Alaskans not looking around and seeing what our share of that self-sustaining should be, because it takes more than a wish and a promise and a hope. It takes real cash. And I don't understand, neither did John Buttrovich, Republican out of Fairbanks, and Zig Ziglar, Democrat out of Ketchikan, who begged the people to not vote our taxes out because they said it took decades to overcome the power of the fishing industry, because they were running, apparently Alaska was run out of Seattle before it was run out of international locations, which I won't go into. But again, it's a question of what do we mean? Are we going to follow up our rhetoric with action and put back the state income tax? Anyway, that's two of it right there, and I do thank you, because I worked the TAPS line from summer of 66 to to November 68, and then 1 year in one 6 month period on the slope. And then 13 years under Standard Oil. I left the year after British Petroleum bought them out. But it's a good industry. It was a great opportunity for Alaska. No, we would not be where we are. Could we be a heck of a lot farther down the road than we are? Absolutely. And maybe we can consult with the Norwegians on how we should do it when we find the rare earth minerals.
Yeah, Caroline, let's talk a little bit about mining here, because right now there's kind of a political stalemate there, in the sense that we have a lot of minerals in Alaska, and there's cost to the environment in getting those minerals out. Where do you think the state, what should the state's posture be on that? I mean, right now we have mining in British Columbia endangering watersheds running through Alaska.
That should stop at the border of Alaska. Uh-huh. So, you know, we might want to dig minerals down in Seattle, but I bet like the devil, or have our sludge runoff go down there. But anyway, no. And my understanding is we do not get a proper amount of Alaska's share of those.
No, we get doodly out of it. Yeah, we get nothing out of it. Exactly.
And that is, of course, I'm wondering, how did we fail basic math?
Well, it has to do with a federal mining law, essentially. you know.
Well, maybe those laws can be changed.
Yeah.
Well, certainly prove that lots of things can be changed.
Yeah, they certainly have tried.
I was not a great fan, but also, how in the heck did we not hear Hickel's comments about ownership? You know, it's almost like we go with our begging bowl to these companies and say, can't we have a little more, please? I don't understand it. It was a clear ownership issue. And whatever we have, as I said, we're not getting it back. But at the same time, we can make sure we don't get taken a second time.
Caroline, thank you for your call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was great. Thoughts, gentlemen?
Well, Norway, first of all, they took a long look at Alaska before they adopted their method. And secondly, they decided not to spend the oil money on that. That's how they created their fund. And they could do that because they had
it was their oil company.
reasonable tax base beforehand. I mean, reasonable from our point of view, of course, it's way too high. But still, that's why they were successful, so successful as they are.
Yeah. I had a guy on one time that talked about sovereign wealth funds, mm-hmm. like the permanent fund, and how that could be an example for other countries. And he talked about Norway, but also in West Africa, where, you know, if the price of oil goes up, they're going to get wealthy. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with, you know, carbon tax and all that sort of thing. Maybe give it 20 years or so. But still, he said, you know, you really, anybody that has these kinds of resources, this idea like a permanent fund is very applicable all over the world.
We're not stuck, incidentally, with the federal law on mining. And look, for example, what the Alaska Natives have done with the Red Dog Mine. It's been an enormous source of funding for them. But we let other mineral development go on. And please, sir, let us give you
the begging bowl.
Let us give you more.
Yeah, it's Red Dog is interesting because there is it's the largest zinc mine in the world, and you know, has all these logistical barriers, and there's considerable value added activity to get it down to concentrate before it's shipped out, and all that is jobs. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Caroline made a couple of points that are worth pursuing, in my mind. We're talking the federal government, of course, and independence or what kind of relationship. To me, the biggest change since the Constitutional Convention and possibly before is the corporate power. Really, that's our masters, and that's you know, we say we lease the oil. They say they own the oil. We're not getting a fair share. I was a firm believer with Governor Egan's Alaska Oil, his concept that if the corporations are like the railroads were back in the turn of the 19th century, they wouldn't get together to put their minerals on a train to seawater. Exxon does not want our LNG anywhere near the Pacific Rim. They are controlling us and what we're able to do. And Alaska Oil or Alaska Gas, those types of initiatives, as Wally Hickel pointed out, the owner state, we do have the ability. And the only time we've really gotten our fair share is by going into the corporate boardrooms, by Wally Hickel saying, you drill or I will. It wasn't going into the president or the secretary of state or the ambassador or anyone else. It was a corporate decision. So it's if we're going to be a self-sufficient state and if the implosion happens, I think we'd be well advised to look at our sovereignty and exercising our sovereignty to its fullest extent.
Hmm. Let's go to Ron joins the program from Douglas, Alaska. Ron, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thank you for having the show on. The gentleman that was just speaking was, I think, was spot on, and one of our failures as a state, as long as I've been in here anyway, and it's been close to 50 years, is that we don't really look at our resources as our resources. You know, it's the whole colonial experience. So until we get to the point where we're more self-sustaining and more responsible about those use of those resources, research has shown that, you know, less than 10,000 acres in hard, good agriculture could meet a huge part of our food demands. You know, there's all the seasonality and stuff. And there's, I mean, what are the real value-added industries in Alaska for our resources? Nothing's done to scale. It's rip it out of the ground as much as you can, as fast as you can. That doesn't create lives for people in Alaska. We don't have adequate training programs. There's some really good things happening out west now in the Delta area where there's apprenticeship programs and people are learning jobs. But what's going on with all this stuff that's happening as far as the industry development? How are our youth being trained to be prepared for this? And the other thing is, time is running out. We've only got, I'm kind of a doom and gloomer. You know, worst case scenario, 2 to 3 generations, and we could be looking at catastrophic changes in our environment unless we make some serious changes now, and we've got to be prepared for that as Alaskans. Thanks a lot.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Ron. I think there is no organization right now. I think the transition cities is a little bit of a movement in that direction. I think a permaculture, people are trying for something like that. But for the most part, I think it's difficult to take a longer view in terms of planning for a more positive future, because there's always some crisis. Steve, there's always something right in front of us.
Can I make a comment on that, Steve?
Absolutely, John Havlock.
I think that caller did hit a really important point, which is that it's not just the stuff we dig out of the ground. It's the brains of the American and particularly Alaskan people that are the greatest resource. And that change in the nature of the world and certainly American economy with more focus on that. And we're falling behind, frankly, and cuts to the university. I'm open to, of course, to reorganization of how education is delivered. It's a whole different topic. But still, that is the major resources, our people, and, you know, the agricultural development that he referred to peripherally. That comes about simply because there are people, science people, that are addressing that issue now, and they're coming out of the university. So that seems to me is the only place where I would say investment is required of public funds.
It seems like we invest and then lose the investment a lot. That people with a lot of talent and brilliance often feel they have to leave because the opportunities are limited.
That's right.
Yeah.
Make those opportunities exist.
Yeah. 1-800-478-8255. It's Talk of Alaska, continuing.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
We're talking about Alaskan independence on Independence Day. What would Alaskan independence look like? And there's so much to talk about, and we've covered so little of it. It's a little depressing, but it's just so much fun to go over this great diversity of topics. Rhea chimed in by email regarding our discussion of the Red Dog Mine and said, hey, watch out for pollution. You know, you know that we haven't solved that problem with the large-scale mining and the bonding for being responsible for the reclamation and so forth.
So we're insisting upon repealing any federal regulation of that, aren't we?
Well, you know, we could be looking at a bit of federal implosion. I mean, when you really look at the federal government, the executive branch is not the most stable at the moment. Congress, 1996 was the last year that Congress passed an actual budget through all the regular ways that they do budgets. Everything else has been like continuing resolutions and not sequestration. since 1996. That's an awfully long time. You know, and then the judicial branch, we probably shouldn't even open that one up. But they have been tending towards returning power to the states, let's say. So in a way, we've got some federal implosion going on.
Well, I sincerely hope that what's going on federally is a once-in-a-century event. I don't, there's, it's not normal, and we've got to do something to change it.
Yeah, and it looks odd from Alaska.
And it's not democratic.
Yeah. Laura joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Laura, and thanks for waiting.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
My question is really around more what was sampled in the teaser for the show, which is what are the pros and cons of Alaskan independence? And I'd like for you guys to talk about how much money we get from the federal government versus putting back into it, and how being a state of the union has benefited Alaska long term, even if there are some federal laws that we have to deal with.
Yeah, well, we did kind of go into that some, but I think all three of us sort of end up coming down with that there are many, many positive aspects of federal presence in Alaska.
Somewhere in the range of 30 to 40%, depending who's measuring it, of our economy is dependent upon federal spending. And we are a huge beneficiary of that. And to withdraw would be a disaster that would exceed the magnitude of the Puerto Rican event going on now, where they're being bankrupt.
Yeah. And Laura, what's your thoughts there?
Well, I just think that when we hear people talking about federal overreach, we are hearing a very, very small amount of what is actually happening, that because we're part of the State of the Union, we get federal infrastructure dollars, we get federal support in many different ways. And when people want to kind of saber rattle and say, oh, federal overreach, we got to get, you know, more combative with the federal government, it's like, well, if we work collaboratively and work to have folks understand what Alaska living is like, I think that that's a better approach than what we often hear from conservatives, which is about like batting back the federal government, which really we owe a lot of our infrastructure and other development to.
Very good. A postal service comes to mind. I don't know what would happen to Bush Alaska without the postal service, or if it had to, if we had to pay the true cost of transporting people's groceries and so forth. I mean, amazing. And Amazon Prime, for some reason, Alaska gets an incredible benefit from Amazon Prime. It's amazing.
All right. Well, happy America Day, I guess.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Laura.
Alaskan.
Yeah. I mean, one possibility, of course, is that because there is considerable federal interest in Alaska, there could be some kind of treaty arrangement of some sort that, okay, you get your national parks, but you have to pay, you know, you get your military bases, but you've got it's rent that you have to pay Alaska for doing that. So rather than having direct federal income, you would have federal income because there's federal interest that they're paying for. The whole federal claim to the Arctic is gone without Alaska. I mean, think about it. That's got to be worth something, don't you think? Well, it's Talk of Alaska, and we got tons of calls here, so let's keep going with it. I think Scott was next out of Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Scott.
Thank you, Steve. And because there's such a short amount of time left, I just thought that we really need to mention the brilliance of the Alaska Mental Health Lands Trust that was incorporated early on. My folks had brought us up in 57 to Fort Rich and moved to Fairbanks in 1960. So I just think we really need to remember how hard people did try to have independent ideas. And I think the Mental Health Lands Trust was just brilliant. That's pretty much all I got.
All right. Well, yeah, thank you. It's certainly an interesting concept, and, you know, I think it's been argued many times that there's not enough money in it. Not enough money. It doesn't generate enough money. And yet, the lands that mental health tends to have can often be problematical and controversial to generate income from. So it's kind of been a double-edged sword. Right?
Absolutely. Well, I think it wasn't in 1978 where the legislature changed everything in the lawsuit had to go forward, so yeah. that a great deal of the very valuable land that was originally in the trust was taken away, and it had to be reconstituted.
Right, yeah. John Havelock could probably go on at great length about that, and of course, Steve Cooper was the attorney on that in that case. We probably don't have time to go there, but yeah, thanks a lot, Scott. That's really good.
Getting me on the air, and the Lands Trust was just brilliant.
All right, thank you. And Jenny joins the program from Fairbanks. Great to hear from Fairbanks, Jenny.
Thank you very much for letting me speak on your show this morning, and I've really enjoyed this conversation. I just wanted to say that I think, and I'm not sure who it was that said that subsistence was fading away. I would have to respectfully disagree with that and also say that I think it's a little short-sighted to not consider subsistence when we're looking at the economy of the state and the independence of the native and rural communities that still do a lot of subsistence hunting and fishing. And I think that it would be wise to consider that in the future, consider it if we do have a constitutional convention. It is entirely possible to write subsistence into a constitution. It's in the Hawaiian state constitution, so it's possible to do. And I think that it would be smart to remember that subsistence creates employment. And a lot of the small rural and native communities are very, very, very short on employment. And when you are doing subsistence hunting and fishing, you are working very, very hard indeed. And I think that rather than saying that it's fading away, we should be looking at the ways that we can continue to incorporate it into local economies and to do so legally, because in a sense, our subsistence hunting and fishing is the equivalent of the small family farm down in the lower 48.
I couldn't think of a better way to conclude this show. I want to thank you very much for that call.
Hey, since she's criticizing me in a way, I agree with her. I guess my observation is a much larger percentage of natives every year are doing most of their income is coming from other than subsistence.
Yeah, you're talking over the long term, but in terms of your constitutional convention idea, she's right on, right?
I agree with her. Subsistence should be in it.
It should be. Mike Kenney, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. It's been a very interesting hour.
Yeah,
thank you.
I don't know if we made much progress, but at least we had fun. And now we can go on and celebrate our holidays. John Havelock, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Steve.
Great. And thank you so much for Wesley Early on the phones and Dave Waldron on the controls. I'm Steve Heimel. Bye.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.